Welcome back to Nocturnal General on Radio 720 WGN. We got the disco ball in the studio now. A few weeks ago, we interviewed, before the death of Prince, we interviewed Nile Rodgers. It was a revealing and kind of dramatic interview. He even touches on some health problems of his own. He's just a cornerstone of contemporary American music. 14, I think he said, what did he say, Dan? 14 times nominated to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I think it was 14.
14 times. I mean, Le Freak, you just heard there a snippet of Good Times. Let's Dance with David Bowie, Like a Virgin with Madonna. He was behind all that stuff. So we're going to listen to a pretty decent interview with the great Nile Rodgers. Our next guest is a 10-time nominee to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's a nominee this year to the Songwriters Hall of Fame. The architect of chic hits like Le Freak, I Want Your Love, Good Times, Upside Down by Diana Ross, I'm Coming Out, David Bowie, Let's Dance, Madonna, Like a Virgin, Robert Plant, Honey Drippers. Nile Rodgers, thanks for joining us tonight. I know I'm missing a lot of stuff.
It's funny. You know what's great is that I can hear in your voice you're looking at a sheet and going, oh, my God, you're like inundated.
I
do about 100 records a year.
I'm out of breath. How you doing?
I'm wonderful, man. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, what have you been working on now? Actually, we'll start in the present, work backwards.
I'm working currently, like at exactly this moment, meaning as soon as I get off the phone with you, Lady Gaga, Miguel, Sam Smith will be in a few months. Disclosure, whom I met Sam Smith with. Oh my God, I just finished Keith Urban. Unreal.
Keith
Such
Urban?
Unbelievable record, yeah.
How'd that happen?
You know, I'm a musician, and I'm a guitar player, and he's a musician, he's a guitar player, and we met each other, we loved each other, and it was just killer, right from the word go.
How do you know when, I mean, I'm going to get into some specifics here in a little bit, but how do you know when things click and when you have chemistry and then when you don't?
You just said it. Either you have chemistry or you don't. And in my case, more often than not, it just feels right. For example, Lady Gaga, we were at a party. And someone just introduced me to her. And she says, oh, I'm going in the studio tomorrow. Why don't you come on over? And that's the song that she was just up for an Academy Award for. That was the song a year ago when we were at a Christmas party.
What about like I know I've listened to the box set, the chic stuff, and you talk in there about how you get lost in music and you just immerse yourself in music. Sometimes you guys would have like three studios booked at once and you jump from one project to another project. Two things there. Can you talk about what those days were like and how you apply that with some of the artists you work with now and just getting immersed in the sound and the vibe?
To have multiple projects going on at the same time, for me, is actually refreshing because you have to sort of take so let's go backwards so we can examine something like that was real. You have to take your David Bowie hat off and then put on your Duran Duran hat or put on your Madonna hat or put on your INXS hat or put on your Diana Ross hat. You just have to go in and you have a totally different mindset because that artistic arc, that person's path in life that you're intersecting with now is a new reality, and it's based on their history. It's based on what brought them there and how you guys are going to go forward together. That's usually completely contradictory to Diana Ross's arc at that time in her life. It has nothing to do with what's going on with Bowie, and then same thing with Madonna or anybody else for that matter, or same thing with Gaga, or same thing with Daft Punk.
And I know you've been in the news with David Bowie. Can you talk about, especially for our local listeners, how he entered your world? It was, you know, with Let's Dance. There was a lull for you after what happened here in Chicago with Disco Demolition.
Talk about
that, what happened to you after Disco Demolition and how you met David.
It was really sort of interesting because we were in Europe at the time when the whole Disco Demolition thing was happening. So honestly, the way that we read about it and the way that it looked for us on an airplane looking at a newspaper, it just looked like, you know, this was also during the time of the ABA basketball league and stuff like that. So we were into, you know, people having big pranks and tricks and stuff like that. You know, sports, you know, was not only the sport, but the entertainment and the magnitude of the entertainment and these events, it just seemed like funny to me. We weren't offended at all. We didn't think they were talking about us at all. But when we got home, it was made overly apparent that not only were they talking about us, but they had pitted this group called the Knack against Sheik. And it's like, the Knack are our friends. It's like, wait a minute. Like, these are our friends. They're in there recording their second album. And Sharona, we know her. It was like, you know, like, what is this? And you could see in the press every day, you know, the Knack were going to be the saviors of rock and roll. And Sheik were like some sort of like, we're dark lords of the underworld trying to keep the four chord rockers from, you know, having that rightful fortune of millions and millions. It was like, what are you guys talking about? I start out in four chord rock bands. There was a time when I could only play four chords. But guess what? I went to traditional music school and I now know tertiary harmony in theory and I can orchestrate and blah, blah, blah. So come on, guys. We're all on the same team here. So it actually caught us completely by surprise until it became wholly real when we started to try and interact with record executives and people that we heretofore had been our good friends. And people weren't answering our phone calls. And, you know, it happens once or twice, and you say, okay, you know, I guess the person is pretty busy. But then you say, wait, I just made a few million dollars for this guy. What's going on here? And then the Disco Sucks thing became very real. You know, it was like scary. And we were in the middle of a contract with Diana Ross, and we got the contract signed, thank God. And we realized that we had to completely change our musical style on this one record, our first record that we were doing as a big superstar. Did that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I've read your blog, your website. We should plug your website, but you do have blogs there. And it's, give us the website.
How about something really clever like NileRodgers.com?
Yeah, thank you. But, yeah, you said how the Disco Sucks thing kind of killed the band, but then Good Times became number one right in the middle of Disco Demolition.
It was, you know, like they say, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plan. So you see two funny things happen in 1979. Not only did we get two number one records, two number one pop disco records, but Le Freak was number one. It wound up going number one in 1979, even though it had come out the year before. And then the Pittsburgh Pirates adopted We Are Family as their theme song and went on to win the World Series.
Right.
So it was like, so every baseball stadium had to play We Are Family whenever the Pittsburgh Pirates showed up. And they wound up winning the World Series. And, you know, we gave them platinum records. Well, Sister Sledge gave them platinum records. So it was just very ironic. And then the song that we had that went number one, Good Times, went number one so fast that, honestly, we didn't even know how to play the song when we were out on tour because we figured that no one would really care. And we had enough songs to carry a show, you know, by ending with Freak Out. People would go crazy. But we actually had to learn Good Times in the dressing room before we went out and played before Marvin Gaye in Oakland Baseball Stadium.
Oh, yeah.
It went number one that quickly.
Two observations on Disco Demolition since it happened here. One, musically, is Frankie Knuckles talks about the death of disco birthing house. Do you see that transition?
Yeah, I could see that because all it was another way of describing dance music and a new decade's responsibility to come up with something new and clever. But, you know, obviously early house and disco are so married. I mean, talk about being joined at the hip. House and disco is like your older brother. You know, yeah. House is just disco's younger brother. Same thing with hip-hop. It's just disco's younger brother. It's like you had a family, and then one person got a job first, and then the other person got a job, and they were all successful. One's a doctor, one's a lawyer, the other one's a professor at a university or something.
What kind of happened with you with Good Times? You hear that in Rapper's Delight.
Was interesting because I believe that unknowingly, Sugar Hill Gang was paving the way for the future. Now records are more like Rapper's Delight than they are like Good Times. More records nowadays have elements of other people's electronic media than not. I mean, more records use samples as part of their grooves. They certainly use interpolations, and that's because they can take the electronic media, sync it up, and then they can remove it or replace it with something else that sounds like it or gives you a similar vibe. Whereas in the old days, we had to just hear something, remember it, and then try and incorporate it into our song. So what I'm really saying is that all musicians are inspired by other musicians' compositions, and then we take them and rework them, like David Bowie used to call it. Oh, no, I don't call it stealing. I call it a postmodernistic reinterpretation of an original idea. I go, yeah, Bowie, we're lifting.
It's like our radio show.
Yeah, I was like, Bowie, we're lifting the beginning of the Isley Brothers Twist and Shout for Let's Dance. Yeah. Note for note, bro. Oh, no, it's not that. I'm like, yeah, right.
Then culturally, the last thing on all that is that in retrospect, people sometimes around Chicago talk about if you just talk about the time period of disco. I mean, discos did bring everybody together. There were all kinds of walks of life at discos. But in retrospect, some people call disco demolition a homophobic and racist event. What? And I know you weren't here. You just said you weren't. But what's your takeaway in that in terms of historical perspective?
Historically speaking, I have to believe that it was just a number of unusual events that collided at the same time. So prior to that event, what were clubs and what was disco culture like? All over the world, and I mean all over the world, I don't know how old you are, but clubs tried to emulate the mentality of the disco mentality. Most notably, the most famous club was Studio 54. So people were very open sexually. Men could go to the girls' bathroom, vice versa. There was no hang-up. If people were, you know, transvestites or were transgender, I mean, everybody felt comfortable. And for the first time in America, I saw an America that I thought was, you know, I'm an old hippie. I thought, this is amazing. This felt more political than the hippies or the Black Panthers or anything I had been involved with. I thought, this is the world that I want to live in, where everybody is cool with everyone, and you're respectful, you understand. No one would say, you know, if a transvestite walked into the bathroom to use the bathroom, and you know, you were guys, even if you were sort of tough guys, you'd say, hey, how you doing? Well, you know, what, you know, it was just... And that was because of the music. And I still know that to this very day because I'm 63 years old. And you go to a Chic concert, my average audience age is 17, 18, 19, 20 years old because they know my music from their video games and the films that have repurposed the music. So they grew up with those songs the same way I grew up with Warner Brothers playing Liszt in a cartoon.
We're going to take a break. This is very, very good. So we're going to take a break. We'll be back with the great Nile Rodgers after this on WGN. Welcome back to Nocturnal General on WGN. We're here with the great Nile Rodgers, who should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Yeah, we were just talking.
The greatest joke of all time.
Well, all these people you've worked with, a lot of them are in there, right?
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, like, I stopped counting so long ago. It was, you know, and what's funny with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is, you know, people call me up who are voting members who say, you're going to make it this year. I mean, my God, for God's sakes, they're putting in Madonna. I mean, you did like one of our biggest albums. You guys sold 27 million. This is going to be a year. You're nominated. Boop, then it comes out. Well, he didn't make the final vote.
Well, June 9th are the induction awards for the Songwriters Hall of Fame in New York City. And I just wanted to read this list of who you're up against there. It's Gloria Estefan. These are under the Performing Songwriters title category. Gloria Estefan, Tom T. Hall, Deborah Harry and Chris Stein,
right.
Ernie, Marvin, O'Kelly, Ronald, and Rudolph Isley and Chris Jasper. a.k.a. Isley Brothers. Jeff Lynne, Madonna. There she is.
Wow.
Michael McDonald, John Mellencamp. This is alphabetical order. Steve Miller, Tom Petty, Nile Rodgers, and Bernard Edwards. And how about this? Sylvester Stewart, Sly Stone.
So oh, my God. It was like, okay, now go to the back of the bus, pal.
Yeah, that is. I was just going to say that. That's a busload of people. But when I was looking at that list, here's a question I want to ask you. Who influenced you as a songwriter?
All of them.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, that's what made me think of that. That was Sly Stone.
I made records with half of them.
Yeah, right. But, yeah, when I saw Sly Stone on there, I just wondered how many of those people really.
Yeah, I was music director for Sly Stone at the Grammys a number of years ago. I've known Sly, since I was pretty young. And 2 years ago in the south of France, we played with the Family Stone. It was one of the best live shows ever.
Why do you say that? What did you get out of that?
Because not only did they play everything perfectly, but, we're old school bands. We don't and I'm not disrespecting anyone, but we don't go out on stage with click tracks and backing tracks and whatever. In other words, if we can't perform it, you won't hear it.
Yeah.
So it's like the other day I was in Hawaii, and we had just performed at a big corporate event. And I can't say the person's name, but it would really make the point. But it's a superstar. I mean, you almost can't get bigger. It's like at top of the food chain, can do anything they want. And their show is the day after us. So my room was looking out on the beach in Maui and looking at the stage that we performed at. So when I woke up, I heard the sound check, and I went, oh, wow, they sound incredible. And I stood on my balcony, and it sounded exactly like the superstar, but the superstar wasn't there. But it was exactly the same. And the dancers were doing their choreography, and it was, like, perfect. I was like, if you came to the Chic sound check, then my girls weren't there to sing, or my keyboard player wasn't there to do vocoder for Get Lucky, it wouldn't be there because we play everything live.
And you will be at the Ravinia Festival here in Highland Park on July 8th and 9th with Duran Duran.
Yes.
And the tour starts real soon, right? You're going to start rehearsals?
In a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you. Well, that's great because Duran Duran's like my second band. I mean, they feel like, Chic Light to me. They're like Chic Part 2 because they came into my life, during the whole Disco Sucks era, and I was able to do my first records with them as part of their band, and their newest album, which has been their biggest hit in 22 years, is the first album I've done with them in 22 years. You think there's a correlation?
Stuff I've read about you on your own blog, you had a battle with cancer in 2010, and you're cancer-free now. I know you've had this question probably before, but how did that just change the game for you going through that and coming out of it?
It's changed everything. I may seem over jovial now, or I may seem like a bore to you. I'm not really sure how to read myself. But I woke up this morning pretty happy, but I also woke up this morning acutely aware that I have to have another round of serious testing. Because while I was in the bathroom shaving this morning, I coughed and coughed up blood. And I went, what's going on? And I felt my thyroid, and the doctor has been watching this for years and years and years. And so I don't know what's going on. And I also know that once you've had cancer, the chances go extremely high that it can return either in a different part of the body or, whatever. So I'm aware of the fact that I'll never be out of the woods, but I'm also aware of the fact that the way that I dealt with it the first time was so wonderful. The therapeutic part, as far as the doctors were concerned, they did what they did. The therapeutic part, as far as I was concerned, was making more music than I've ever done at any period in my life. And that's why I've got, records with Daft Punk, Pharrell, Avicii, Adam Lambert, Keith Urban, on and on and on. Nicky Romero, Ten Snake. Hundreds and hundreds of records. Sam Smith, just like just over and over and over again. So I got tons of records coming out. And I couldn't be happier from an artistic side, because most composers are fairly anonymous until after they die. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what I'll get to Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I hope not. Let me ask you this, for listeners, all your fans listening to this, what spiritual and emotional insight, or I don't want to use maybe the word advice, but I guess so, what advice would you give to anybody listening who might be going through the same challenges you went through?
I really don't like to give advice when it comes to stuff like this, because the one thing my doctor told me, the guy who was my sort of real close general practitioner doctor, he just said to me, he says, "No, you need to go home, sit down, meditate on this, and think about this. And you need to find out as much information as you can, and then make your own decision, because this is a life or death decision. And you don't want to be angry with anyone but yourself, or happy with anyone but yourself." So, you know, I just tell people what I did. And that's what I did. I read everything I could. And when I decided on a particular course of treatment that seemed to fit my life, that seemed to be the best thing I could do, which would allow me to continue to do concerts and stuff like that, I went for that. So I went for radical surgery and just said, you know, if thine cancer offends thee, pluck it out.
We'll be back with more of Nile Rodgers after David Jennings in the news. He's going to talk about his upcoming appearance at Duran Duran at Ravinia and the festival circuit. So don't go away on WGN 720. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on 720 WGN. I'm Dave Hoekstra. We got Corey Dennison in the on-deck circle. We're going to wrap up our segment with Nile Rodgers, where he's going to talk about his work with Diana Ross and I'm Coming Out and his upcoming appearance at Ravinia with Duran Duran. So take a listen.
So Fold Festival is something that I created a few years ago. I call it Freak Out, Let's Dance. Main reason why I started that festival is because they wanted to honor me at another really huge festival. And I had performed at that same festival dozens of times where I had honored other big people. Here's something that's curious. Two times that I honored people at that festival, they died within a few months. So I said, you know what? Don't honor me, man. Let's honor the music that brought me here. And they thought, that's an interesting approach. So I did 11 continuous hours of straight dance music. It was unbelievable. I had everybody from Mark Ronson to Cerrone to Grace Jones to Chic. It was just all night long. And then we wound up having breakfast at 6 a.m. for everybody. It was fabulous.
Wow. And the one on, I'm looking here at the schedule for the one in London, June 24th, June 25th, and June 26th. You got Beck on June 25th.
Yeah. So now I've had Beck at my Fold Festivals consecutively. He played here with us in Riverhead, New York, and smashed it. Now he loves Fold Festival. It's great.
Is the New York one booked yet?
New York one is close to being booked, okay. But I don't want to give away the name, so I got some really cool people coming.
And when will that be?
That's going to be August 12th, 13th, and 14th.
Okay. A couple other things, and we'll wrap it. Again, I just want to confirm.
Well, you should have finished with the lineup in England. Okay. It's like an amazing lineup, but it's.
Okay. Alison Moyet on the 24th.
Yep, there you go.
The Thompson Twins.
Thompson Twins, yay.
Tom Bailey on the 24th.
Yay.
Dan Long, our producer. Are we going to London for this?
It's if you're paying.
Chic all three nights. We got to say that. Yeah.
So that's what's cool about that. The way that I do these festivals is that my band, we're the host. So a lot of times, not only do I play with the other bands, like here, I performed with Duran Duran, I performed with Beck, I performed with Keith Urban, with Pharrell, with Chaka Khan. So we become the host band. And we join their bands, and it's just great. Like, we call ourselves the Grateful Dead of dance music.
That's great.
Our roster of songs, like our set list, is a mile long.
I see Angie Stone here on the 26th.
Yeah, yeah. Angie Stone. We were just doing her arrangements yesterday.
That's great.
Killing. Yeah, it's great.
That's great. New York, and it's just because it's been in the news. Can you tell us the story of you meeting Mr. Bowie? I mean, you met him at the – what I read is you met him at the Continental New York Club. Were you with Billy Idol?
Correct. Yeah. Billy Idol and I walked in.
Yeah, pick it up from there.
And Billy and I walked in, and he went, "Bloody hell, that's David Bowie." And as he says Bowie, because how English people call him Bowie, he barfed while he was saying Bowie. He went, "That's David Bowie." He wiped his hand on his sleeve and walked and went, "Hello, Mike." And by, at that point, David and I were like engrossed in intense conversation. And neither of I had known about the other's love of jazz music, and that's what linked us together. So because of jazz, we were just linked forever, and that's why a record like Let's Dance exists. What David Bowie wrote was a folk song with very, very traditional sort of folk chord changes. What you hear as Let's Dance is what I did when I said, David, even though I've been running from the word dance since Disco Demolition, if you, David Bowie, are going to call us on Let's Dance, you better damn well make sure people want to dance to it.
And you had history. I mean, besides the jazz thing, you knew the Young Americans in the mid-1970s and all that.
Oh, yeah, they were all my friends.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Half of them played on on Chic Records, and I played on Luther Vandross's record, and we all were on Sesame Street together. We all started out together at the same high school.
Yeah, yeah. And how'd Stevie Ray Vaughan get into the mix? I don't know that.
Stevie Ray was the only person that Bowie brought to the record. So when we did the album Let's Dance, David Bowie only knew two people, Nile Rodgers and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Everybody else who played on that record he had never met, maybe never even heard of. Omar Hakim, who's now become world famous, and the guy we call Pee Wee, the bass player, who's been Rod Stewart's bass player for like all his life. His name is Carmine Rojas, and Tony Thompson was the drummer from Chic. And our keyboard player from Chic. So, it's funny how people say Chic's last two records were David Bowie and Like a Virgin.
Yeah.
Especially Like a Virgin. I mean, Like a Virgin is basically Chic playing every song.
Yeah, right, yeah. Have you talked to her lately, Madonna?
Madonna? Yeah, I saw her. Well, it was like a year ago. We saw each other at the Grammys. I was sat right behind her. And it was like the most loving kiss of the night. Like, all the paparazzi took that shot. It was like, come on, guys. I'm just saying hello to my friend.
I'm going to ask you about I'm Coming Out. I really like that song. So tell us about I'm Coming
Out. You do.
Yeah, tell us about I'm Coming Out, Diana Ross. Band in concert, right? She saw Chic in concert?
Yeah, we met Diana Ross. She was backstage at our show. And the interesting thing for Chic or about Chic in the early days, we really were a studio band, like a Steely Dan. So we lived in the studio. So we weren't these big sort of social butterflies that everybody knew. So when we turned back and we saw Diana Ross standing there watching us perform, we're like, I don't know her. What is Diana Ross doing at our concert? So we went backstage and she went, oh, that was so cute. And we're like, cute. We're out here killing these people. We are sweating. Our violin players are totally covered in sweat. And she calls us cute. We're like, okay, Miss Ross, I guess you can call us cute. So we go and she comes to the dressing room. We start chatting. And we see that she's interested in having us write and produce her next record. But unbeknownst to her is that when we take on an assignment like that, we do everything. Like, we don't hire, orchestrators or anything. I do all the orchestration, and so it's basically like her moving into another Motown. So we talked about it, and we had just had this huge record with Sister Sledge called He's the Greatest Dancer and We Are Family, and we didn't want to have the rift that the lyrics of those songs somehow created with us and Sister Sledge. We didn't want to have the same process happen with Diana. So before we decided to write one note of music, we interviewed her, and that album is basically as if we were journalists. So we're musical journalists telling you about Diana Ross's life through our lives, you know, through our music. And the song "I'm Coming Out" is particularly because we recognize her almost godlike status to the gay community. And I found out one night completely by accident by going to the bathroom in a transvestite club. And I'm standing there at the urinal, and on either side of me, there were at least three Diana Rosses. So I was like six deep in Diana Ross impersonators. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. This is the most ridiculous thing ever. And now remember, the first star I ever worked with was Diana Ross. Before Diana Ross, everything else, even though we had a bunch of platinum records and stuff like that, were all homegrown. So I couldn't even run throughout the club and go, oh, my God, I'm working with Diana Ross. I'd feel like an idiot, like, you know. So I ran outside and called my friend, my partner, on the pay telephone and said, you will not believe this. I said, dude, I was just like in a Fellini movie on steroids. I'm in the bathroom, and there's like all these Diana Ross impersonators like practicing their songs. And like I said, man, we got to write a song called I'm Coming Out. My partner was half asleep. He went, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I said, please just write this down because by tomorrow I'll forget it. Write down I'm Coming Out. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, well, just like Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud was for James Brown, I'm Coming Out is going to be like that for Diana Ross, even though she doesn't know it yet.
That's the type of story you only hear on Nocturnal Journal. but it has. That's why I wanted to ask you about that. It's become like a gay pride anthem. It's really taken on some legs, you know.
And not only that, she will not come out on stage until they play I'm Coming Out.
Yeah.
And when she finally found out the dual meaning of the song, because every chic pen song has a dual meaning. It's what we call deep hidden meaning. So there's the frontal meaning that everybody sort of gets, you know, the aw, freak out. There's the underlying meaning that most people don't know about unless they hear me tell a story about the fact that Studio 54 didn't let us in that night, and we imagined what was going on, and the song was called Aw F Off, not Aw Freak Out. So it was actually a protest song that turned into a celebratory song. So when we noticed that, you know, like the sort of jokes that go around are, you know, to prove if you're gay, you know, like you want to decorate someone's house, you listen to show music, you listen to Diana Ross, and you love Cher or something, or Judy Garland or whatever, or Liza Minnelli. And I was like going, oh, we could take the stereotypical bull and turn it into a real thing, like give it real legs, take something that people make fun of and make it into a real emotional moment. And so, but we couldn't tell Diana Ross that because we didn't know what her position was. Anyway, she came to us one day and told us that the number one DJ in all of America, Frankie Crocker, who was running WBLS, and he told her the meaning of the song, and she said that he said that it would ruin her career. And she asked us point blank, why would we ruin her career? And we answered her point blank, first time and only time I've ever lied to an artist. I says, what are you talking about? Gay? Gay has nothing to do with this. This is going to be the opening song for your show the rest of your life. It's you coming out. I says, Diana, what do black musicians call the first song of the show? We call it our coming out song. What song are we coming out with tonight? What song? Are we going to come out with Chic Deer? Are we going to come out with La Freak? We're going to come out with this. It's our coming out song. I said, it's stolen from, you know, people who have, you know, who go to cotillions. And Chic, we think of ourselves as sophisticated. We were making up lies faster than you can imagine, like in real time, just coming up with tons of BS because we knew the song was a monster and we knew the gay community would rally around her when she goes, I'm coming out. They're going to go, yay!
Last thing, and then we'll wrap it up. Thanks again for being so generous with your time. Where did you get, I've never talked to you before, where did you get, I mean, tell us about your upbringing in New York. I mean, tell us about your parents. Where did you get your loquacious nature?
I'm a New York City kid. I was born to a 14-year-old mother who gave me up for adoption, and then I guess her maternal instinct got the better of her, and after a few months, she went and retrieved me, and I remember my mom's 21st birthday like it was my birthday, because at that point I was 6 going on 7 and I was really big. And my mom is not much taller than me, so I grew up basically as my mom's friend. And because I was such a fanatic about watching movies and the Marx Brothers and stuff like that, I read this movie by Chico Marx, Harpo Marx, called Harpo Speaks, and he's the Marx brother who pretends to be mute. And he tells the story how he left school at 9 years old and got a job. And I said, I want to be like him. And he became a musical virtuoso, as they all were. And that's what I did. I sort of left school and studied music on my own and got jobs. And my first job was with Sesame Street at 19 years old. I was a total New Yorker, completely immersed in music, and have been all around the world. And it's funny, you know, like watching our political process, you know, watching an election go on, and I think to myself, you know, it's really funny. I know more about politics on the ground in every country they're talking about than those guys do. What do? They fly in with a big entourage and bodyguards and stuff. I fly into any country I want, and I go to somebody's house and meet someone at a bar or meet someone on the beach, and I'm just naturally curious. So all of the stuff that these guys are talking, I'm going, what are you talking about? It makes no sense. Nobody would believe that if you were there. So I remember last year I did a concert at the United Nations, and I saw how all of these musicians who couldn't speak other languages, but somehow we still made great music together. And I said, that's it. I figured it out. Every politician should learn how to play a musical instrument, and they should jam together and make a record before they have any kind of political decision, because it makes you so close. It makes you so loving, because it's hard. You know, music, you create something from nothing, you know, which is all art. You just have an idea, and the process of doing that makes you close. It makes you understand people. That's why, after all these years, who are my best friends? Who do I love the most? I love Sting. I love Lady Gaga. I love Madonna. And these are all people I love. You know, I can't help it, because we've gone through the greatest ups and greatest downs together.
Thank you so much, Nile Rodgers, future member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame at the Ravinia Festival with Duran Duran, July 8th and 9th.
And the Fold Festival.
The Fold Festival in London.
And New York.
And New York.
And London. Well, they're not going to go all the way to London, but they may go to Riverhead, New York, because it's the Hamptons, and it's amazing, and it's fun. You're going to see a bunch of movie stars and cool, beautiful people, and we have the best food and wine you've ever had. It's great.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your contributions in making this world a better place now.
Thank you so much,
okay,
man.
Take care of yourself.
Cheers. Take care. Like the legend of the Phoenix.